Eyes Without a Face is a horror classic from 1960, about a mad scientist kidnapping young women so he can steal their faces for his disfigured daughter. It's a very influential film from a bold new age of horror, so let's take a look. Welcome everyone to Screams After Midnight. I'm now realizing I should have got some bandages and like wrapped them around my head for the start of this, but welcome everyone. It's a horror movie podcast. I'm Peter, and joined as always by Tim.
Bonjour.
Do you know any more French? Or is that
oui?
So you just said yes, but the answer is actually no, which I think is just nah.
No.
Nah. Nah. Yes. Yes, welcome everyone. Today we are talking about a classic film. We're looking at Eyes Without a Face. This was a vote winner. Our patrons over on, well, Patreon, that's where the patrons tend to be. I mean, you could be a patron and not even know it. But yeah, so they voted on three
look
movies.
Look to your left, look to your right. If you don't see a patron, then you're the patron.
Yes, that's how it works.
That old saying.
So... yeah, this was a vote for three movies that were on my top 100 that we hadn't done yet, and Eyes Without a Face was the winner. It's a French film from 1960, and we'll get into it, of course, but we'll start spoiler-free, just in case, you know. I imagine a lot of younger folk probably haven't seen this, so you can get a sense of how we feel, and then we'll get into spoilers and talk about it a bit more in depth. But just before we do get started, I'll just remind you, if you are enjoying the show, hit the like button. Helps out a bunch if you do. More people will find us. And you can get some bonus content, including an extra episode every month over on Patreon, but I'll tell you more about all that stuff at the end. So, yeah. The basic premise of Eyes Without a Face is it's a bit of a mad scientist movie. We've got this doctor, this surgeon, who is kidnapping young women so that he can try and replace his own daughter's face, which was badly damaged in a car accident. So... that's it. That's the premise.
Face off.
You think this was inspiration for John Woo's seminal 90s action movie Face Off?
I mean, the similarities are boundless, I would say.
The tones, though, are very different, I would say. Very, very, very different atmospheres in both films, I would. Mm-hmm. Mm. There's no Nick Cage in this hamming it up.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. All right. Well, Timmy, had you seen this before, actually, before I even ask anything else?
Yeah, I had seen it at some point. It's funny because this is one of those ones where if you would have asked me, I would have sworn that we had done it on the show at some point just because, again, if I mean, guys, we've been doing the show so long now. I can't even remember the shows we did last year, but.
That's a fair point, yeah.
I felt like we had talked about it at some point before, but maybe I'm just thinking of, like, you know, bringing it up on, like, a, you know, top whatever list or something. So, yeah, I'm not sure when, but I know at some point I seeked it out. Most likely I was probably doing some type of, you know, filling in the gaps of, like, whatever, you know, people say are, like, you know, the best horror movies of all time. Or maybe I saw, like... you know, I'm trying to think. Maybe I wouldn't be surprised if Stephen King might have mentioned it in his Dance Macabre book, which was kind of his writings on like the horror genre, and he talks a lot about different movies that influenced him stuff. So I wouldn't be surprised if that was mentioned at some point there. But yeah, it had been a while since I'd seen it, but I had seen it before. Honestly, I didn't really remember too much other than basically the look of the. I don't know if I want to say necessarily the villain, but, you know, the woman with the titular eyes without a face, I guess you'd say. But yeah, so I guess just go into my thoughts here. Yeah, I guess I'll probably sound like a little bit of a cretin because I don't hate the movie or anything, but I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily like in love with it. Like, I think it's fine. It's one of those ones where. Yeah, I mean, I can understand why, you know, it has its rankings and, you know, horror history and everything. But yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily moves my world. I do think they're, I mean, these type of movies, for me at least, I do have to be in a particular mood. So I did watch it yesterday after a long week of work and traveling. So I wasn't probably the best headspace to watch it. And I don't know, it's not a long movie, but it was a little slow at parts. And obviously it's, you know, pretty old, which isn't necessarily like a bad thing. I don't want to sound like a, yeah, some uncivilized brute that can't watch anything, you know, older than the 90s. But it was, you know, it did have that old timey feel that was a little slow at some parts for me. But I think what, you know, and I'm going to assume this is probably, you know, why it ranks so highly among most people. The thing that, you know, does save it for me from, you know, just kind of writing it off as being some old stuffy, you know, movie is, you know, I do find the look of the, you know, the woman with the mask and everything to be, you know, quite haunting. Like there is a very creepy look and aesthetic to it. And I do find the last, you know, I guess third or so of the movie to actually be pretty enthralling once kind of everything is going down. There's actually some good like horror and mayhem and stuff that's going on. So yeah, I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from.
You bring this to me on episode 580 of this show. You come to me with this horrible take. I've had to sit here and listen to you defend Leprechaun movies, and
I think we are recording on the anniversary of Leprechaun 2, just to put it out there.
How do you know that? I'm sorry, are you
everyone's talking about it.
No, they're not. Are you subscribed to some sort of weird Leprechaun fan account that is just every time there's an anniversary, like they get 8 of them a year because there's 8 Leprechaun movies. Like, hey, it's the anniversary of Leprechaun like in space today. Oh, it's in the Hood 2's anniversary today.
These are important dates.
They are not important dates. They are stricken. In fact, everyone with a birthday on any of these dates should change their birthday to the day before or after, so they don't have to share a birthday with the stupid Leprechaun movies.
I know you can like legally change your name, but I'm pretty sure I don't think you can change your birth date.
Well, they should. In fact, I should be illegal not to. Yeah, okay. I mean, okay. That was painful to listen to, Tim, quite frankly. This movie is very, very fantastic. It's haunting. It is slow, but it's refreshingly slow. I found this a delight to like watch just nice long takes of like the woman in the mask like going around the house and just quietly taking it in. You know, it's obviously in French because it's a French movie, but there are large stretches where it's just visual. I'm sorry, Tim. Did you have a witty retort that you wanted to insert there?
I just think it's funny to say that it's obviously in French. Like, oh, like what tipped you off when they started speaking in French? Like,
that's what makes it obvious, Tim. The word so obvious funny. Means that. Oh. I'm going to strangle him. I think it's surprisingly violent in a couple of specific moments that I don't think you could get away with a movie in America in this time period.
I was surprised that at some of the stuff that happens in the ending. I was like, oh, wow, they're going for it there.
Yeah. Well, you say ending. I think there's something right in the bang in the middle that I think is probably the most gruesome moment of the whole movie. And I'm like, oh, I'm surprised they showed this much and they went this far with it. Because, you know, the first time they sort of hint that there's something wrong with Christine's face. That is the titular eyes, as Tim put it. She's just sort of got her head like pressed down into like a pillow and like they're kind of hiding it. And it's like, oh, it's going to be a kind of classy movie where we just avoid it with like camera shots and like where we're looking and all that. And it is for the most part, but it does go a bit further than you expect it to with that stuff at one point. But no, I think it's very well paced. I think it's pretty haunting. I think it does that sort of tragic Frankenstein-esque thing where you're kind of your sympathies and who you're sympathizing with is kind of challenged. There's kind of like a beauty to it. It's a movie that's kind of about a lot of things. It's about how we perceive beauty. Shut up, Tim. It's about how we perceive beauty. There's some misogyny in there. The idea of playing God is definitely in there. Obviously morality is a big part of it. Like, all these things are at play throughout the movie. I will say it does feature two of the most useless detectives I have ever seen in a movie. I'll talk about that in spoilers. But otherwise, I think it's a beautiful film. I think it looks great. I think the current version you can get of it from Criterion looks fantastic. It's been lovingly remastered. Very sharp. What did you all
talk about? I watched it on Max.
I mean, it's probably the same transfer. Mm-hmm. Was it in HD, Tim?
How would I know? It was on my TV.
What do you mean, how would you know? It would be a blurry mess if it isn't.
I don't think it was that blurry.
I can't trust anything you say now, Tim. The trust has went out the window. Oh, bloody hell. So, no, I think it's excellent. There's a reason why it was on my top 100. And for me too, it had been a long time actually since I'd seen
this.
What
was the reason?
Everything that I just said.
Okay. Just making sure.
That umbrella of quality that I was referring to.
Okay.
Yeah. This movie that is a film, unlike that Leprechaun dreck that you pander on about.
I mean, I don't know, it's different tastes for different folks. I think Leprechaun gives you some things that, this movie necessarily doesn't, and vice versa.
Yeah, headache.
Yeah.
Dear. I was kind of worried about this when this one. I thought, oh no, I can see Tim being a right little shit about this.
You put it on the list. I mean, you knew it was going to happen.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying, but when it got to the point where it was, oh, it's clear this is the winner, I was like, oh no, this is the one where I could see Tim being extra Tim.
Well, I mean, I think I'm being pretty fair. I said it's fine, and it's not like I said it was bad.
Look, I'm just trying to make this entertaining, Tim, all right? It's not going to be a fun review if you just sit there and go, oh, it's fine, and then I just ignore you,
all right?
I've got to interact with you occasionally. It's one of the burdens of doing this show.
Yeah, can't wait till I mean, normally I'm not a big proponent of AI, but but when we can work out the kinks and we can just get the AI version of me to do the show, it'll run a lot smoother.
I don't know if we can program an AI to replicate you, Tim. That may not be possible.
That might be what shuts the whole operation down.
Yeah, the entire internet's just going to break if we try and have it replicate the mind of you.
You know what's funny is I did have to have a meeting at work about implementing AI to do some of my functions, and my boss was basically telling me, like, yeah, so we're hoping that we can get it to do like this, this, and this. And I was like, oh, okay, that's my entire job. So, fun times. It's a fun world that we live in right now.
Maybe replaced by an algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who'd have thunk?
Yeah. Okay, that's just where we're going with life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, do you know what's got no AI in it? Eyes Without a Face, because it was made in 1960.
Is the director still alive? Because I'd love to see him do a special edition where he just like CGI's like a special edition style. Just, I don't know, throw a Greedo in the background or something.
Pretty sure he's been dead for like 30 years at this point.
Well, rest in power.
Yeah.
Our condolences to the French family.
Okay. Right, you could have just said his family. They don't have to specify that they're French. I mean, they probably are, but I don't think it mattered. Oh, dear. Okay. I'll give you a slight critique. I do think the music that plays that's supposed to be when, like, some stalking's happening is oddly, upbeat and hijinksy.
Yeah.
I'll
yeah.
give you that. Mm-hmm. Some inner quibble.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like... I'm trying to think off the top of my head, like, what would be the oldest movie that has, like, a really iconic soundtrack? Because, like, I don't know, like, I mean, you can kind of think of, like, some of the, you know, like, old-timey music cues and sings and stuff that you get, like, in the old Universal stuff, but there's not a lot that I feel like is very, like, oh, yeah, man, that's such a great score. I mean, that's one, you know.
Psycho's out the same year as this, and that's got the, I mean... You know, that's
definitely iconic. Yeah.
It's not like a hummable melody or anything, but the sharp strings as the shower curtain opens is pretty iconic.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that. Psycho was the same time as this.
It's actually interesting because Psycho's often like credited as being, hey, it's the horror movie that took it out of like Transylvania castles and stuff like that and put it in the modern world. And I think it's interesting that this does that too. This is, you know, this is about women being kidnapped out of Paris, and taken to a sort of nearby, you know, house that's just on the outskirts of the city. Like, this is set in the modern world. This is like real people, you know, relative to like the time it was made in, like being kidnapped. Like, so
that's interesting. Yeah. It does have that thing though, where it's like, you know, America is very. Self-centered, so probably is like, well, I mean, that doesn't count because it wasn't American. I think I think I was looking at some stuff about this on the Wikipedia. I think they did bring it over to America, but like I think it was like a couple of years later. I'm assuming. I don't know if they would have like dubbed it at this time or what they would have done, but I assume the American version is not that good. Or at least as good as this.
I mean, it depends if they change that, I suppose. But yeah, I think. I mean, if nothing else, it just kind of shows that the direction was moving in the same way all over the world. That they were doing more contemporary horror stories, and you know, horror wasn't seen as like a classy genre at the time. You know, I mean, to hell, arguably it still isn't, but certainly at the time. It wasn't as common to do horror movies unless you were just in like cheap little nasty things. So the fact that this is quite classy and feels like really masterfully directed, much like Psycho really sticks out.
Because that means Peeping Tom would have been around the same time as well, right? Because wasn't that around the same time as Psycho?
Let me just double check the number on that. But it's about the same. It's definitely, it's 1960, same year.
Yeah. That was a British.
Yeah, film, so that's and we've got an American, a British, and a French movie, all from 1960, all doing present day, like modern horror movie stuff.
Interesting.
Which doesn't sound obviously special, but today's stars up. Most horror movies come out and they were set in the present day, not everyday world. But it was really common before this for everything to be. Yeah, it's all castles. It's all set back in like olden times, or you know. That kind of thing.
That's all that gothic, like dark and gloomy kind of stuff. I don't know if people are going to be able to see this on the video. Are they going to see the arrow that's on there? Okay, you just moved it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just making sure. I wasn't sure if people end up seeing that or not. Well, I mean, now I see it, in the overlay and stuff. But before, it's like,
oh, wait, no, no, you can't see that. No, you're. So okay. So Tim is being distracted like a cat because he can see my mouse cursor moving over the video feed that I'm sending him.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure because I didn't want people furious that that there was a cursor on screen.
not to worry. Okay. That's not being recorded. That's just been sent to
you. Remove it in post.
I'll remove it in post, though. We've got a CGI budget.
Fantastic.
Right after I put in the CGI version of you. Yeah, I mean, honestly, we'll probably just say spoilers and get into it. But clearly, Tim's not as into this, but I would highly recommend seeking it out, especially if you like older movies, especially if you like kind of slow-paced, thoughtful cinematography. It's actually a really simple plot, all things considered, but I think it's very, very good. So, spoilers for Eyes Without a Face. You've been warned.
The spoiler section might be a little interesting because I was kind of surprised that, not that I want to say like very little happens in this movie, but you know, it was kind of a very like straightforward plot. Like there isn't like a ton of, you know, I guess twists and turns or like, you know what I mean?
I mean, it's part of its strength, I think, is that it's more about dealing with like the impact of each moment than it is about like trying to swerve you left and right. But it is interesting because if you go into it completely blind, and I kind of spoiled this in the spoiler-free section, but it's because it's the general premise of the movie. But the movie doesn't let you know that his daughter, the doctor's daughter, is alive, that Christine's alive, until about 15, 20 minutes in. Like, we spend some time with the public story, because as far as the public's aware, she's dead. And that's kind of what the first 15 or so minutes of the movie are kind of about.
And it's kind of funny, because that's the opposite of Christine, where, like, the opening scene is you finding out she's alive.
Are you referring to the car movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cinema's second most famous Christine.
Yeah, we haven't done Christine on the show yet. We'll have to.
We haven't.
No, believe it or not, we haven't.
Wow. We'll probably wait a couple of years till I can watch it with my son. He loves cars, so that maybe that'll be a good horror movie.
Oh, yeah, sure. So sometime after the 10-year anniversary. because the opening of the movie this character, Louise, I think her name is, who's like the assistant to the doctor. She is driving down the street, and there's someone in the back seat. But it kind of becomes clear that the person in the back seat's not alive. It's just like someone with like hat and sunglasses on, and they're kind of rocking about. And she's effectively dumping a body in the river, in the River Seine, specifically. And this body's found soon, and one of the first big scenes of the movie is that our main doctor character is brought in to identify his daughter, because this woman is missing her face, right? Her skin is missing, right, around her eyes and around her cheeks and all that. And they bring him in, and they also call in another guy whose daughter's been reported missing. But the doctor gets there first, and when he sees the body, he identifies it as his daughter, and that he's sad. And the story that he's sort of selling here is that his daughter was so depressed about what happened to her in the car accident, and she lost her face, that she has seemingly committed suicide.
That's like a dark thing, but it is just like kind of weird. Like, I mean, I guess it could happen, but like, what kind of car accident just like leaves you pretty much completely intact except for your face? Like, it just perfectly rips off like your face.
Well, I don't know if it was necessarily ripped off. I mean, was it, could it be burns or something, like our face landed in like fire or gasoline that was on fire or something? I don't know. Like a Harvey Dent thing, but the whole face, like one face.
She drove into some acid.
No, but I think what's really great about this scene is that he's very quick to identify the body, and when he's on his way outside the police station, the other dad who was called down, who clearly you can kind of infer by this point that this has to be this guy's daughter, because he's lying. Or, well, if you know the premise, you already know that Christine's alive, but what's so good about this scene is that this dad is like, oh, did you really look at her, and you're sure it's your daughter? And he's like, yes, I'm sure. And it's very, like, quiet. The doctor's quite cold with them, and I love that it works really well, because you get that the doctor's feeling guilt in this scene, or you can argue that he's not feeling guilty per se, but it's awkward because he's effectively, this is the man whose daughter he stole and murdered to try and like give his own daughter a face. That's like, I think that's a really strong scene, and then from there you follow him home. It goes through the whole motions where he gets into the garage, he gets out of the car, he goes up the stairs, and we follow all these steps. We follow him going up the house because it's building to the reveal, which is when he gets to the bedroom and he starts talking to someone on the bed, we find out that it's the daughter. She's still alive. Christine's not dead. And that this woman who was dumped in the water is someone that they kidnapped. And it's something we're going to be seeing his assistant Louise do throughout the movie. She's going to go looking for more victims, and that also mm-hmm. starts quite quickly after this point. We sort of learn around this part of the movie that, when I say learn, we kind of infer, because Christine, mm-hmm. you know, doesn't, like, she's clearly not happy with her situation, but we get this, like, beautiful set of sequences with her where she just sort of starts to go around the house, and one of the motifs of the movie is her with doves, and she looks up at a painting mm-hmm. of herself with doves, and Louise gives her her mask. You know, she's been hiding her face, she puts on the mask, and it's kind of like a big reveal when the camera finally turns around and you see her wearing the mask for the first time, because it is kind mm-hmm. of a haunting image. It is one of the inspirations for a lot of things, but including Michael Myers, like the Shape's mask.
Oh, sure, yeah.
is very much an evolution of the mask and Eyes Without a Face. Mm-hmm. This is obviously more like a hard shell, so it looks more like a doll face almost, or something like that.
It's almost boy-esque, you could say.
Why have you got to ruin this? Why do you have to ruin this, Tim? I'm sorry. Did I murder a close friend or something? Who have I done?
I mean, if you have to ask.
I've done nothing to you.
No. I will agree, though. That is, I think this is definitely the, at least for me, the highlight of the movie is just this whole look is very creepy, very haunting, as you put it. Like, anytime she's on screen, pretty much doing anything in this mask, it is, like, yeah, very eerie and chilling, and that it works. I think especially in black and white, this is just, like, this look is kind of made, you know, for black and white. I think it looks good.
Yeah, the movie looks great. And as she goes through the house and she's kind of looking at different things, like one of the main themes of the movie, because I mentioned she looks up at the painting and she's got like the doves or whatever on her. Later on, you see her with a bird cage and the doves are in a cage. So it's all kind of representing that, much like the dogs that the dad, the doctor, uses to experiment on to practice his skin grafting, she also feels that she's trapped, that she's an experiment, that she's not free, that she's not alive, that she's already in some way dead. So that's like a big part of this. And when she gets to like eventually the end of this long trek throughout the house, like it's her at the phone, and she picks it up and she calls someone. And I don't think I got the first scene, like who she was calling. It wasn't until the later time she calls him that I got she was calling her fiance, because she was engaged when this car accident happened. And the fiance thinks she's dead. That's something else we learned, because they have like a funeral for her, and the fiance is there shaking hands along with the dad, and he's like, "Well, that sucks." I guess this is what happens when you have this horrible accident that disfigures your face, but your dad happens to be this experimental, like skin grafting, like surgeon. So he gets all these delusions of grandeur. He's like, "I'm gonna fix her."
I mean, yeah, and thank God, like, if he was just a dude that, like, could do ass transplants or something, then, like, she'd be screwed.
She would have just big ass cheeks for her face, yes. Maybe
if we make the ass big enough, it'll distract from the face.
I like the idea, though, that, like, they never intended in doing this whole faking her death thing. That was only because they found this other woman's body, and they had to, like, explain it and be like, "Oh, that's my daughter. Yeah, that's her. So, you know, so now she's officially dead."
Yeah.
So I don't know. I like that was just them improvising. But it does call into question what happens when you kill anyone else, which obviously does come up in the near future. So
yeah,
because it's around here. We're introduced to two detectives who aren't doing too much yet, but they do introduce this woman who was picked up for shoplifting, who happens to look a lot like Christine and all of the women who are victims. Because that's the thing. They keep going after women who have similar hair, similar faces, blue eyes, which is interesting. And I think this is intentional. I don't think this is a mistake, because part of my brain goes, why does it matter if they have the same hair and the same eyes? Because you're not transferring any of that. You're only taking the skin and the face. So what does it matter? Yeah. The skin complexion is the only thing that really matters in this case. I mean, maybe overall shape of the head, perhaps, as well. But I think this is sort of going into the theme of, like, the idea of the movie about the vainness of all this. And, like, no, it has to be a beautiful woman who's beautiful, just like my daughter, for this to work. It has to be someone who's on par, when in reality that's like, that doesn't mean anything. Like, you're not taking their eyes, you're not taking their hair, like, you know. So it just kind of points out how superficial, like, a lot of this actually is when you stop down and think about it. So
yeah, I mean, the doctor is, you know, excuse my language, but just he's a grade A jerk, because, you know, any yeah, I think any you know, father worth his salt would say that, you know, that it doesn't matter what your son or your daughter looks like, they're always beautiful in your eyes.
Instead, he says, "Get used to wearing your mask."
You freak. I can't take you to Notre Dame looking like that.
Yeah, because that's where French people go to do things. Notre Dame. He's, you know, he is, like, he's an outright kind of villain. Like, there's moments where he's supposed to show remorse, or like where he'll say, "Oh, I've done some horrible things to achieve this miracle." He says that at one point. But there's never any real sign that he's going to change or anything. He clearly is just this way. And there's if anything, he's actually less likable or more villainous than even like a Dr. Frankenstein is. Because as bad as what Dr. Frankenstein does, and like him playing God's a big problem in that story, he's only taking dead people's like parts. He's not like ruining living people and keeping people prisoner.
Right, yeah. And then obviously, like, once he unleashes his monster, he, like, you know, feels remorse and
yeah, he learns what he's done. Yeah. Nah, so whereas this guy
is just like, well, all right, that's the, you know, fifth woman we killed. Let's go find another one.
Yeah, and that's kind of Louise's thing, is we see her like stalking the streets of Paris, and she finds the next victim, and we see her befriend her and be like, "Hey, I've got an extra ticket for the opera," or whatever it is. And then she's like, "Hey, by the way, I know you're looking for a room to stay in the city. I found one. It's in this house just outside the city. I'll take you there. I know the owner." And I think I was thinking, oh, there's going to be more of like a prolonged thing here where she stayed in the house for a couple of days or something before they finally strike, like they're prepping for her. Instead, no, like, she literally comes in and says hello to the guy. And she can tell, this woman can tell something feels a bit fishy about this, and she's trying to make excuses to like just leave as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. But Daddy Doctor just chloroforms her, and that's it. She's out. They take her to a secret operating room, which is behind like a closet in the garage, and like hooks her up. And we see the process. And one of the things I really like, actually, is that there's other versions throughout the movie of the eyes without a face. One of them, of course, is this woman. After she's had her face taken, she's in bandages and you can only see her eyes.
Oh, yeah.
But another one that I thought was nice and subtle is actually, and it's more natural, is Louise and the doctor, when they're doing the operation, they've got the face masks on and the caps on. They're basically only showing their eyes. Yeah. And it was kind of like a comparison with the ears. Because I think another big part of the movie is the idea that the doctor's always hiding his true face. That as much as his daughter's the one wearing the mask, he's wearing the more insidious mask. And it's not until the end of the movie when his face is mauled by dogs where you're like, that's who he really is. This is the monster that he actually is. Yeah.
Yeah, it works.
I don't want to ruin you making fun of the movie, Tim, but I've got to actually say nice things about it because it's good.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't argue with that. That's some good stuff in there. I do always love a good bandage look. So I will. Cat scratching me. I did think, you know, that was cool. And then, one thing that's kind of neat is, like, you know, we're talking about how this is bringing, you know, kind of horror into like a more modern setting for the time, but it kind of feels like a nice little bridge, because stuff like, you know, kind of like the hidden laboratory and stuff, it still feels like it has a little bit of that old, you know, kind of like spooky castle or gothic feel, even though it's like kind of, you know, merging it with like this more modern stuff. So that was interesting.
Yeah, it's a little bit more high tech. And even the fact that this guy is a plastic surgeon, effectively, or maybe that's not quite exactly right, because he's not doing like Botox or like fillers or anything like that. But I can't even say he's just cosmetic, because I suppose technically his entire thing is like helping people with damaged skin. So that's different, of course, than just someone who goes and gets something done because they feel like a change. But even that feels very modern, right? I can't imagine that was that old. Maybe it is. Maybe there was older versions of this type of practice, but it feels like a fairly modern idea. This is where we get to she's on the operating table and they're drawing the outline of where they're going to cut, and it's like, okay, this is kind of creepy. But then he gets a scalpel and he starts actually cutting, and it's a simple effect because obviously it's just the classic thing where they're shooting out a little bit of blood at the tip of the blade so that it looks like they're making this incision. But I'm like, even this for 1960 feels kind of extreme. But then he actually starts sort of peeling at the face, and Louise, the assistant, is putting the clamps on the edges of the face to hold it up. And I'm like, this is actually going much, much further than I would have imagined, before I saw it. It's a lot more graphic. And they do a smart thing where as they take the face off at the end, you only kind of get a glimpse of what's underneath, and then it fades to black. So it gives just enough to get your imagination going, which actually we glossed over. But before the operation, Christine wanders in to the operating room. She finds the area and sees her on the table. And she looks down at her, and the girl wakes up and sees her standing over her without her mask on. And it's actually the first time we get a glimpse of Christine without her mask on. But it's always out of focus and kind of blurry. So you can see they've put makeup on her to make it look all damaged. But at the same time, it's never quite in focus, so you can really get a good look at it. So it's like they're sort of hedging their bets and be like, okay, we may not have... And they wouldn't have said this at the time because they didn't know who Tom Savini was. We don't necessarily have Tom Savini makeup here, but we can, play around with what we've got and make it look as good as it can in the right light.
Not to distract, but something that was weird was that I just noticed on my search bar on my computer, I thought there was a little eyeball on there. And I thought it was oh, that's so weird that we're talking about this, very eye-centric movie, and there's a little eyeball on there. But then when I kind of, physically zoomed in with my head, I noticed that, it's actually the... I guess it's supposed to be an eclipse. It looks like the sun with the moon all blacked out that in front of it. But, it looked like a little eyeball. So
thanks for that, Tim.
You're welcome.
Oh, dear.
I didn't want anyone to wonder why I kind of zoomed in a little bit.
Again, you keep saying zooming in. That's not how most people would describe them leaning their head in.
I'm just in such a cinematic mode right now.
Basically, this is the thing. They're happy that it doesn't happen on camera. But they start talking afterwards that they've transferred the face, and it seems to be taking. Louise is quite hopeful that it's going to keep. And they're like, okay, but what about this other girl, Edna, I think her name is, she survived, she's not dead, unlike the other girl that we did this to. And he's like, I don't know yet, but just make sure she eats something. And we see her, she's got all her face bandaged up, and she wakes up, and when Louise tries to feed her, she attacks Louise, hits her in the back of the head with the bottle, and goes running throughout the house. And at this point, we haven't seen Christina yet with the new face on, and I was wondering how they were going to handle this. Are they going to, have the actress who played Edna play Christine now because it's her face she's taken, Face Off, where they swap faces. They don't actually do that. When we see Christine in a couple of scenes time, she's her own actress playing the role, and that's whatever. But Edna, sadly, they sort of chase her throughout the house, and she kind of goes upstairs, and seemingly when she sees her reflection in the mirror, dives out the window upstairs and kills herself, which was actually really well foreshadowed earlier on, because they were mentioning Christine was saying, you've removed all the mirrors so I can't see myself, but that doesn't mean there's not reflections. The windows show reflections at certain times of day, There's steel surfaces. There's knives that have reflections. There's lots of things that I can still see myself in. So mm-hmm. I think that's the implication here, is that she saw her reflection in the window and chose to end her life, which is really tragic and sad, because mm-hmm. her face was literally stolen.
This is the original identity theft. this scene wasn't it wasn't like super, it wasn't like gory or anything, but it definitely like was a dark scene. Like, again, I mean, at this point in the movie, I'm not surprised because lots of dark things happen, but I just kind of surprised that overall, like, how dark this movie is for the time.
Yeah, it's not like it is super graphic. It's just that, that image looking down at the dead body on the ground with the blood coming from the head, you wouldn't think twice about seeing that in a movie, like, even 10 years later, I don't think.
Yeah.
But I think it's because you don't see it in black and white that often. I feel like... obviously there's some modern black and white movies, but by and large, black and white usually means it's an old movie. And I feel like you tend to associate that with being a tamer time, and this feels like it's... still provocative in a lot of ways.
Yeah, like, I love, like, you know, the old Universal monster movies and stuff, but, like, usually in that you would just get, like, someone kind of coming at you, like,
yeah.
That would be, like, the extent of the horror. Like, you usually wouldn't see, like, very gory, bloody stuff.
It's more hokey. Well, there's nothing about this movie that is hokey.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, it's definitely got, like, a sort of elegance to it, but it's not hokey in its execution, for sure.
It's anti-hokey.
Yes, anti-hokey.
It sounds like a dance movie you do at a wedding or something.
Are you thinking of the Hokey Pokey?
Well, this is, like, the anti-pokey, which is, like, the opposite of that dance.
Wait, is it the anti-hokey or the anti-pokey?
The anti-pokey is part of the anti-hokey dance.
Okay. Moving on. this woman has died. And we get a whole scene here where the doctor, like, and Louise take her to the cemetery where... Mm-hmm. The quote unquote daughter has been put in a crypt, and they, like, open her crypt and dump this dead body in with her. And part of me's thinking, this is genius. This is a cemetery. There's maybe dead bodies here. This is actually the perfect place to put a dead body.
Mm-hmm. Smart.
I was thinking, you know, the perfect way of doing this is if you see, like, a fresh grave, like one that's just been, like, dug, like, or filled, you could dig mm-hmm. that up, put the body in next to the coffin, and then just put the dirt back in. And no one would be the wiser because it was a fresh grave anyway. Like, no one would notice a thing.
The perfect crime.
The perfect disposal of the crime. I don't know if... how good the murder is on you, okay? I can't help you with that part.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not condoning any form of murder, for the record.
Oh, no, of course not. No.
No.
No, that's one thing we won't condone on this podcast.
So... from here, they're happy. We see a scene where they're with Christine, and she's like, oh, you're all hopeful. We kind of have to send you away for a while and give you a new identity because you're supposed to be dead, but everything's great. But then the doctor looks at her face and sort of starts to look a bit concerned, and he admits to Louise that he thinks he's failed, and then we get this sort of, like, still frame kind of section where it sort of shows her, like, 5 days later, and then 10 days later, 20 days later, so on. And it's like the skin didn't take. Like, the skin that's been added starts to rot because it's not actually connected to the living tissue. This promise that he gave her has dwindled. And now we're back to, like, hunting for more people. And I think what I like about this and what makes it so tragic to me is that she is kind of convinced by it, like Christine, that is. And this, like, dinner scene or whatever it is, when they're having these conversations, she does seem genuinely happy that she has a face again and that she can have this fresh start, and then it's taken away from her. I think the idea to me is that for the rest of the movie, she's then forced to reconcile with the fact that she was happy about it for a little bit, and that'll just make her feel more guilty about what they're doing to other people to give her this face. Because what I was alluding to earlier, that the detectives are useless. The detectives don't stop anything in this movie. They don't solve a thing. They get close where they should be able to like intervene and actually help someone, but instead they actually put someone in danger and go away thinking there's no problem. It's Christine who saves the day. Christine makes a noble choice by the end of the movie, which saves someone's life and ends this nightmare once and for all. So, yeah, all that's great sort of stuff dramatically. Basically, Louise is out looking for more people, and the police have started, the two detectives have started to notice that there's a pattern to the girls that are going missing, and they're like, hey, that shoplifter, we've got an idea. They're basically going to use her as bait. And it's actually when they're talking to the fiancé, who comes and speaks to them, because Christine has, for a second time in the movie, called them. And you get the impression that she's calling them, like, maybe not every day, but often enough that he's getting used to these weird phone calls where no one's speaking to him, because he sounds quite frustrated. But you maybe get the idea that she just wants to hear his voice, that she's, like, missing him and wants to, like, just hear him say anything. And because she says something, she says his name, he recognizes the voice. So he goes to the police and says, hey, I heard her voice. This is weird, right? And they end up talking about these abductions. And the only details they have from like the friends of the victims is that some woman with a pearl necklace has like been involved in the abductions. And he's like, hey, that does sound like someone I know, actually. That sounds like Louise. Shut up. Sounds like Louise, the assistant character, which we never mentioned this earlier, but she, like, the reason why she's so devoted to the doctor and helps him with all these murders is because she herself, like, had a damaged face that he fixed. She's got a scar on her neck underneath the pearls that she wears. Well, that's why she wears them. It hides the one scar. So, yeah, that's her whole thing. But, yeah, so they can talk this plan to submit this woman, the shoplifter, into the clinic where the doctor works. That's his day job, because he does have a job. He's not just at home all day doing crazy experiments on dogs. Like, he does have like a regular doctor job as well. And the plan is to, like, oh, let's see what happens if we put her in here as a plant. But they don't seem to like actually keep watch and see if anything bad happens, because when they do some tests and she's all right and the doctor says, oh, just discharge her, she leaves the building and immediately Louise comes in with her car and says, hey, can I give you a lift? Kidnapping her, because it cuts straight to her on the operating table with the line drawn around her face. Like, she's going to get her face cut off, right? She's going full Nicolas Cage with the face off. And I was like, wait, why wasn't there the police waiting outside to see if this was going to happen? And then the fiancé doctor, he like phones the police and says, hey, like, she's left. There was nothing wrong with her, so they already like processed her and got rid of her. So the police are like, oh, we'll check and see if she got home okay. Oh, she didn't? Oh, the doy. What's happened there then? Like, if you're going to use an innocent young woman as bait, maybe, just maybe, actually have one person keeping an eye on her, actually watching to see if something happens. I mean, I guess their assumption was is that if he was going to like kidnap her or do something, he'd do it from within the clinic. But clearly, he's thought about that. That could be tied to him too easily.
Yeah, it feels like they kind of just came up with like the first part of the plan, and they're just like, we'll call it a day. Like, I'm sure from here on out it'll work.
Yeah, I mean, we get a big bit of tension here because they show up at the clinic to talk to him, and this is what interrupts the surgery, because, you know, Louise comes and gets the doctor and is like, hey, there's two policemen at the clinic, which is like next to his house. So he's like, oh, crap. I'll go speak to them. So that interrupts and saves her that buys her some time. And he goes over. And he basically just convinces them. He gets, oh yeah, here they are, here's the paper, she was released earlier today. Once she's out that door, she's not my responsibility. And the policeman and the fiancé go outside and basically say, oh well, it was worth a try, wasn't it? And they shake hands and say goodbye. And that, I'm like, guys, she's literally on the operating table like next door. She's about to get her face cut off. You're just... You're just getting out. I thought maybe, oh, maybe they'll hear a scream or something. Mm-hmm. Actually, is it here where Christine takes off the mask and looks at her? Maybe I was mixing that up earlier.
Yeah, I forget exactly when, but...
Yeah, I said that was the first victim. Mm-hmm. It might be this victim. Maybe the shoplifter mm-hmm. girl. I can't remember. I'm maybe mixing mm-hmm. up two scenes there. But she... yeah, there's a great reveal here, though, with the camera in the operating room. Like, the doctor leaves, and the camera pans over to find Christine sitting in the room. And I thought this was a very interesting detail, because earlier on in the film, she's so separate from all the surgery stuff, to the point mm-hmm. where she kind of has an idea that it's happening. She knows that her dad's up to stuff, but mm-hmm. she's very separate from it. She's not seeing it. She's been very coddled from the reality of what's been done to try and save her. And I thought it was interesting that here, for this victim, no, she's in the room. She is witnessing exactly the horrors that are happening mm-hmm. on her behalf. That she's not chosen, for the record. This is something that her dad has decided to do for her. She's not asking for this. And I think this was the sign that she is... like, because the movie could have went, obviously, a couple of different directions here, but to me, this is the sign that she is watching this, and she's taking it in, and she's considering what she's about to do, which ultimately is that she frees the shoplifter and then frees all the dogs that are in kind of the room next to it, and then the birds, the doves as well. And this is where the dogs run outside. Doctor gets his comeuppance because the dogs all jump him, and he's earned this death. Like, he's absolutely earned these dogs, because we see him.
It's very satisfying.
Yeah, there's a quick scene earlier on where you see a dog's a square of fur from a different dog. So mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw Poor Things yet, Tim, but it's a little bit Poor Things. It's not the head or anything, but it's something. Yeah. So he gets mauled, and the final shot of the movie is Christine walking through the forest with the birds around her, and it's all it's very poetic. It's very kind of beautiful, and she's kind of free of not literally the prison, that as well, obviously, but she's free of the hold that this man in this kind of obsession with how she looks. It feels like she's actually free to just live now.
It's funny, because I mean, I don't know if this would have been as, you know, if that type of iconography would have been, you know, as present at that time. But it feels almost a Disney princess kind of thing, where you know, she's walking through the forest and she has birds, you know, on her. It reminds me, I don't know if not sure when Snow White came out, if it would have been,
I think it was Snow White's before this. I want to say Snow White's the 40s or something like that.
Okay, yeah. I guess it doesn't matter. I guess it just throws me off because that's in color and that's in black and white. But I guess animation is a very different thing.
You know? Well, there was movies in color before this as well. It's just that it was more expensive to do that. True. So,
but I don't know. I thought that was a very interesting dichotomy of it's a very it's that kind of Disney princess look, but a more kind of dark, twisted kind of way.
When you think about her character arc, it is this positive thing where, I mean, earlier on in the film she literally says she wants to die, she wants to kill herself to because she asked Louise, can you go get me some of the stuff that you give to the dogs and pump me full of it so I die, and she's like, oh, you can't think like that and whatever, but by the end of the movie, it feels like she's more accepting of who she is. So it's kind of she's over it. This obsession that everyone else seems to have. Because it's like you said earlier, the dad's supposed to say, oh no, you're beautiful no matter what, I accept you for who you are. Instead, he's like, I can fix you. You're broken, and I can fix you.
He's toxic. Yeah. I mean, that's very interesting, and then I mean, she becomes pretty badass by the end. It's pretty cool, and kind of talking about how important it is to show her actually being in the room and seeing what's being done. I feel like you can kind of make some metaphors to how we just very mindlessly consume stuff and not really worry about where it comes from, but once you're actually seeing oh, like, this is the price I'm paying for, like, you know, the beautiful face I want. Like, it's easier when, you know, your dad is just telling you, oh, yeah, like, you know, I'll do it or whatever. Not to say that she's not, like, you know, completely innocent. Like, you know, but, like, I mean, once you're actually there and seeing...
He's literally testing on animals, which is something that beauty products have traditionally been notorious for, is the idea of being animal tested. So, I can see that comparison. Yeah, that works.
And then too, I was also pretty, again, kind of just shocked by, like, how blunt the violence is when she actually ends up killing Louise. Like, she just stabs her with the... I think it's just a scalpel.
Yeah. Well, that's not Christine. Well, that's a shoplifter girl who stabs her.
Oh, okay.
Apologies. No, you're right, actually. You're right. They're both in the room. But I think it is Christine that stabs her. Sorry, I think you're right.
Yeah, because she like, frees her. Like, she uses that to cut off her restraints or whatever. But then, again, I guess I'm just used to more, like, you know, like, the Universal Monster movies or something where, like, yeah, if they weren't going to do... like a bit of violence, like stabbing someone, that they would, you know, do it like off screen, or like you'd show them, you know, about to do it and then it would cut away or something. But like, you see, like, you know, the thing like sticking out of her. Like, well, I was pretty surprised
by that. They even shoot it in a way where they're expecting you to be surprised by it, because with the actual impact, the actual penetration happens when you're looking at her back. So you don't see it and you think, oh, that's fine. That's all we're going to see because it's this time period. And then it cuts to a shot of her front and the scalpel's just sticking out of her neck. And yeah, I think there probably should be more blood, but this, you know, it still looks pretty, you know, for the time period, it feels quite violent, like you say. So,
like, this would probably be like, you know, watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like, which I guess notoriously is not like the bloodiest movie, but like, you know, at that time that felt like, you know, very shocking. And then I'm sure watching this was kind of like that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's a really standout moment. Like, all the moments where the surgery stuff's happening, it really stands out.
Yeah. Yeah, like, this whole last section, I was, you know, very into. Like, it moves very quickly, and just, like, there's a lot of stuff I was like, oh, shit. And then, like, yeah, and then, you know, leading up to, like, the dog attack. Like, again, I was very surprised at how, like, brutal that looked.
Yeah, it's a crescendo. Although I'm curious, when are you counting the start of this last bit? Are you counting the face cutting off of the previous victim? Because that's like probably a good half hour or so before the end, I would say.
I mean, I guess just this last little chunk of, like, you know, basically, I guess when, yeah, maybe he's about to do the surgery and then, like, you know, the cops interrupt it, but then, like, she frees the person, so... All the stuff, like, around, like, the last victim and freeing her and then killing everyone, basically.
Yeah. As much as I'm joking about the cops being useless and just leaving, because I'm trained in movies for them to, like, hear something at the last second and come running in and save them, it does make it a lot more poetic that it's Christine herself who solves everything. Like, she makes the choice. Yeah. She breaks free and saves this final victim. No one else is going to die in her name. Like that does all feel very kind of like poetically dramatic, which is good. So, you know, I appreciate that. I mean, the overall themes of, like, the idea of, like, how, like, the fact that she wants to die because she's not beautiful anymore, and I think even the other characters, like, feed into that theme. Like, when we go to the police station for the first time and we meet these two detectives and they're talking about, oh, the women that are kidnapped are always the same beauty. And he's like, speaking of beauty, what did I do with this shoplifter over here? Like, even they have a couple of little, just, you know, like, not super sexist comments, but just a little thing where they're like, oh no, this woman that I'm talking to for my job is defined by the fact that she's attractive. That is something that comes up in these conversations. And it's there kind of throughout. Louise as well is very much all about her face. She's loyal because he saved her beauty. That's how much of a slave she is to the idea of being beautiful. So it really paints this idea of, like, just how desperate people are to keep it. And like you say, you could translate that to, like, what they're willing to, like, ignore is happening to have their looks. And you could even extend that to something as, you know, broad as, like, being a vegetarian and, like, you know, like, not wanting to think about what's happening to the animals that are ultimately ending up on the plate, kind of thing. Out of mind, out of sight, you know? So,
absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of parables you can make to, like, pretty much probably every modern convenience we have. Like, I'm on my phone all the time, and I'm sure if I stopped and think about, you know, whatever country is being forced to manufacture the microchips or whatever, I'm sure it's all very unethical and horrible. But yeah, we turn a blind eye to a lot of things because it makes life a lot easier.
Mm. Yeah. And yeah, a lot of this is just beautiful. I think the cinematography is phenomenal throughout. Whether it's the quiet moments of Christine going through the house, or the more frantic moments of the victim with the bandages going through the house, all of that stuff is beautiful. The final shot of her going through the forest with the doves or the birds around her, there's a lot of shots in this where you could say, "Hey, that's you." Like, pause it, print it, put it on the wall. You could frame it, and it would look good because it does. Almost any shot with Christine in it probably applies to that because of this. Again, it's this kind of like surreal, uncanny valiness of the mask and just having the eyes come from this blank, expressionless face that's over the top. Really good stuff. Like, I think this is a movie that the direction and the haunting atmosphere, along with its themes, are really a lot of what drives it. But it is surprisingly dark and violent in a couple of spots as well. But it doesn't pull punches in quite the same way I'd expect something from 1962. So,
right,
like, you know, if I'm compared to Psycho, because I don't think Psycho's the better movie. Like, Psycho is like a you know, masterpiece, but like, this probably has the more shocking visuals in it, if I was to compare them.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Psycho has like some really good stuff, but it does feel like, yeah, maybe some of the stuff you would, I mean, I guess at the time, you know, it was pretty groundbreaking, but, you know, stuff like the shower scene, it's not like you're actually seeing the knife go in and stuff. No. And, you know.
No. Yeah. Obviously, it's really well done how it is executed, but, like,
yeah.
And that's not to say that we.
It's not a knock, you know.
Yeah. And it's not to say that I'm ascribing value to just how violent or gory something is, but this does stick out as being a lot further than just what I'd expect for the time period. So. And yeah, part of that is probably this outside of the US. It's somewhere else that, you know, was a bit more open to some something grotesque, I guess. But yeah, it's very good.
Is, the French extremity craze begin here.
Yeah. Also, I mean, I have to say, like, the director here, Georges Franu, I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of that. I don't think I've seen anything else he has directed. I'm not familiar with his other work. IMDb tells me he's known for Thomas the Imposter and Teresa Descaro. I'm probably butchering that pronunciation as well. This seems to be the movie that he made. It's just, you know, it's a cult classic that's, you know, well loved by many. You mentioned King was inspired by it. I suspect a lot of filmmakers that grew up in the 60s and 70s and started making movies in the 80s probably are inspired by this.
I'm sure, yeah.
It's just one of those types of movies. I really can't recommend it enough. I think it's a great slow burn that builds at a nice pace to a lot of big stuff happening at the end. It's got a villain that's easy to hate, but he's not like comically villainous either. Like, there's just enough of like realism to him that he doesn't just feel like a maniacal movie villain. He feels like someone who is a little tortured by what he's doing, but is ultimately willing to just keep doing it, and that's what almost makes him more evil in a way. He's like, he's willing to live with the bad shit he's doing.
Oh yeah, there is something to that, like, the banality of evil, I suppose, where it is just kind of like, yeah, he's just going through the motions. You know, you don't really see scenes of him being like tortured or questioning what he's doing. Like, you know, like, oh, like I hate it, but I must do it for my daughter. It's like, yeah, like, he's just way too comfortable.
Well, I think part of the truth is this is something I think Christine, the daughter, realizes as well, is that it's not really for her. Like, that's a convenient excuse, but I think the challenge of pulling this off means more to him than her.
That's, you know? That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is more about his work and his passion.
It's all ego, it's all tied up in his work, and also, not wanting to have an uggo daughter.
Yeah, that's the phrase he used. It's even implied at one point that he's kind of responsible for the car accident. Not so much that he intentionally did this to her, but it was his own recklessness that that caused it. And that's another interesting little wrinkle to throw in there. That I mean, you could argue that's maybe guilt's driving him, but I genuinely feel like it isn't really about her. He's just obsessed with what he's doing and pulling it off.
Sure.
And it's like, even if you succeed, this will never become legal. No one's going to, this is never going to be something you can actually practice out in the open or whatever. You're always just going to be the mad scientist behind closed doors doing this on the on the lowdown. But you know, I compare it to Frankenstein a few times. You can compare it to you know, any of those sort of classic stories, maybe even something like wasn't Strantz and Guildenstern are dead? Is that the story I'm thinking of?
I know the title, but honestly, I don't really know much about it.
Yeah, maybe I'm not thinking of the right thing. But either way, like, it definitely has some roots in like more classic stuff, whilst transporting it into a very, very modern interpretation. Because what is not a perfect taking of something that is vaguely Frankenstein-esque and saying the modern version of that is doing it just purely for vanity than the actual creation of life?
Of course, yeah.
There's something really beautifully dark about that, and sadly rings true with the world. You know, she needs to be look good for her TikToks, you see. So she's got to have a nice face. So it works. So.
Yeah.
All right.
It's two very different stories, but the look was reminding me a little bit. I'm just kind of thinking of it now because I'm thinking of like other stuff to compare it to. And honestly, it's not really that good of a comparison. But what jumped into my mind is, I don't know if you remember that episode of Tales from the Crypt where there's like that really jerky guy and he hooks up with that girl on a Halloween, and they like both agree to like keep their like masks on or whatever while they're doing it, and she has like this kind of like white porcelain mask on.
Wasn't this like the one good episode in the last three seasons? It was like the only one we liked.
I forget which season it was. I do think it was one of the later ones, but yeah, it was like one of the like actually good ones.
I think I remember it vaguely. Yeah.
It really has nothing to do with it other than like, oh, like her face kind of had like a white mask looking kind of thing. It is even super similar to this, but I don't know why it popped into my head. But I like that episode, so I wanted to bring it up.
All right, well, now you get to disappoint everyone, Tim, and rate the movie out of 10.
I mean, I don't know. Again, I'm not trying to be negative or anything. I didn't hate her or anything. I just I liked it enough. It obviously has a reputation of being a classic, so when I watched it, I was just like, okay, yeah, I get it. I can see why people like it. It's just not the kind of thing that I'm necessarily always into, which, if you want to call me a buffoon or whatever, that's fine. Also, again, I don't know, there are times when I'm in the mood for these type of things, and maybe this was just an off week or whatever, but I can't deny, like I said before, that there is some really striking and like, you know, beautiful haunting like imagery in it, and just that, you know, that white mask face is just very, you know, it's just a very good look, and anytime that was on screen, it was definitely, you know, perked my interest, and again, I like a, you know, a lot of the stuff in the end. Yeah, I thought it was very good classic horror movie stuff, but. Again, I can't deny that there was some earlier parts where it was just like a little slow for me, and I was just kind of watching it going like, oh, okay, like, yeah, I see what you're doing there. But yeah, I'm still going to give it a decent score, because like I said, I think it's fine. Like, I don't really have anything negative to say about it, but I guess, you know, I didn't go to film school or study, you know, a fancy French cinema, so maybe I'm not appreciating it at the level that it should be, but I'm still gonna give it a 7, though. I think there's enough cool, haunting, you know, classic horror movie stuff in there that, you know, is worth checking out, and give it a, you know, recommendation. But yeah, that's about as far as I go, I guess.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, no, I mean, I, like, obviously I've said most of what I need to say. I will add on here, because I don't really talk about the performances that much. Mm-hmm. I think the actor playing the Doctor is very good. He's very sort of cold and calculated. I think the actress playing Christine has got a tough job, because she has to do a lot of acting without most of her face, because she's in a mask most of the time. So a lot of her performance, other than the eyes, of course, is her body language. It's her moving around the house. It's her, how she's hesitant to do certain things, or like the way she moves. Like, again, like you can, some of it is creepy because of the mask, and like you don't really know what she's going to do. And that's one of the things that's effective about the like when she's about to cut the final victim out of the straps, is like you don't know what she's going to do with that scalpel. Like, part of you's thinking, oh, this is going to be a dark ending where she, like, goes full tilt like her father. And instead, no, she cuts her free, and that ends up being what the conclusion of her arc is. But, like, she has to do a lot of performing without a lot of the obvious, more normal, like, you know, she can't smirk. She can't, like, emote with her mouth in any way for pretty much all the movie, barring that one scene at the dinner table where she's got the face. But, yeah, so... Yeah, honestly, for me, I think it's beautiful. I think it's rich in themes. I think it's paced really well. I think I am just about giving it the 9 out of 10. I think it's excellent. I highly recommend it. So, I was very nice for Tim's top 100 vote winner that we did last month. And
well, yeah, I gave you Psycho Gorman.
Yes, I gave you Eyes Without a Face.
Yeah.
The people will be on my side. I'm sure they will.
We'll see. I thought it was very fair. I'm not saying anything negative about it. I'm just, you know, I gotta be honest. I'm just, you know, I'm not saying that I was like, oh my God, stop everything. I gotta, you know, write a blog about it or whatever. I don't know what people do when they like movies anymore.
Oh dear. Dear. All right, that's I guess that's the show, everyone. Next week I think is the off week where patrons get the exclusive episode. So if you're a patron, next week you can expect a little movie called Spookies. So look forward to that bad boy. And then we will return for a regular episode the week after. We'll be starting to chip away at 2024 movies with a January release by the name of Night Swim. So look forward to that. But that is what is coming up. Like I said, you can support us over at patreon.com/MailFuzzTV. Get the exclusive episode, like I mentioned, for next week. You get one every month. You also get other bonuses at the $5 tier. You get even more stream segments where we'll do things like a random top 5 or Mount Rushmore. If there's a bigger news thing that we feel we should talk about, we may do an even more streams on that. It has to be a couple of those every month. So go and have a look. Plus there's bonuses for all the other shows we do on Mail Fuzz Movies. So go and have a look. But that is us. So thank you once again for watching or listening. We always appreciate it. Keep watching scary movies, and we will see you next time.